would be, you know, a little bit of background on other kinds of religious communities in America, and then today we might compare and contrast Holden to some of the other kinds of religious communities that have existed in America really ever since its beginning. The first religious community in America was, of course, you know, Boston, where the Puritans, who tried very hard to have an organized, what we would call intentional community, that it was all planned out according to a specific plan, not just a bunch of people moving in and taking over the land, you know, letting the chips fall. And right up through to the present, obviously, we've had a lot of religious communities, a lot of very interesting kinds of religious communities in America. I suppose the most spectacular one of all would be the Mormon community in Salt Lake City, the Great Trek West in 1846 and so on. And I thought today, for those who are interested in this, we could just give a little background and then talk about Holden as it harmonizes with and how it contrasts with other kinds of religious communities. And then I thought tomorrow, since I did it 2 weeks ago, and had a good response, I could talk about one very specific religious community which is still very much alive and flourishing today, called Koinonia Farm, founded and managed for a long time until his death by Clarence Jordan. Some of the staff, in fact, here have been at Koinonia Farm. It's in South Georgia, in a little town called Americus, Georgia, and they sell a lot of pralines. If you're from South Georgia, you sell a lot of pralines, obviously, just like Stuckey's. The big orange signs, right, and so on, right? You know, clean restrooms, you know, and free half pound with a 10-gallon fill up, and so on. But that's a very, very, very interesting kind of religious community, and it has many, you know, similarities with the one here, and it has also many differences. So if you have the chance, there's one book in the bookstore which I used a couple of weeks ago, called by it's there where my name is. It's called Biography of Theology. And it has several portraits, verbal portraits or written portraits of specific individuals who have made, you know, a significant contribution to our understanding of how we can express our Christianity in our lives. And I'm going to talk a lot about, tomorrow I think we talk a lot about Jordan as one chapter in that particular book, and I think it gives us a better understanding not only of religious communities in general, but specifically about Holden itself. Because Holden is really sort of unique among religious communities, yet there are, I think, a remarkable number of parallels with others. And so for that reason, I just want to give a little bit of background, and then I'd like your reactions to Holden, and your understanding, and you know, your evaluation, and what it might be. And ask yourself whether or not you'd like to stay here, you know, for a period of time, other than not having to cook or answer the telephone or something. That aside, which is something you can't really put aside. Everybody who first gets here gets so tired out the first day or two, and they realize it's because they don't have to, you know, all the old chores and grind. I remember Rich Kamer, was just about exhausted when he first got here. He just couldn't believe it. And no committee meetings. And finally, obviously, if you've been to his presentations, he's very much alive now. Okay, just a little background on religious communities. I don't want to make this sound like a classroom lecture, because you get lectured at enough, and I'd much rather have discussion. But in order to understand Holden, really, I think we should look at sort of the general types of religious communities that have existed in this country, and draw some conclusions as to why some of them succeeded and why some of them, and most of them, in fact, have failed. I don't want to talk about failures necessarily, but it's true in this country that most religious communities over a long period of time have failed in terms of living up to their original intentions. Some of them have adjusted, such as the Mormon community have adjusted. Some have adjusted inevitably, because you can't stop, you know, what do you want to call it, progress or change, and you can't keep living out in the desert as they did in the 1850s and so on, and obviously they've had to change. Some have succeeded. And what I want to try to suggest is that there are certain general patterns as to why some have succeeded and why some have adjusted, and you know, and why the great majority of them have failed. Maybe failure is the wrong word. Maybe it's very possible that at a certain period of time, certain individuals who got into religious communities were convinced that this was the will of God for them at that particular time, and that after a certain period of experimentation and living in a community had expired, then it was time to move on to something else. It's they may have failed according to, you know, earthly standards or worldly standards, but they may not have failed, you know, according to others. Because it's impossible to measure the you know, in quantitative terms, so the way you can measure, you know, a bank statement or something, it's impossible to measure the impact of living in a religious community, you know, on individuals. It isn't a matter of balancing out the ledger at the end of say a 3-year experiment or anything else like this. So maybe failure is too strong a word, but by original standards, I think it's probably the best word we can have. Now, I think very briefly there are sort of 3 general periods where interest in religious community have been, you know, especially strong in American history. If you look back, it's almost as though the growth and appearance and decline of religious communities go in spurts. It's not a steady, you know, year in and year out, decade in, decade out kind of a process, but it's a process, if you like, in which there is intense interest in religious communities existing for a certain period of time. Then other forces come along and help break down this enthusiasm and dedication to living in religious community. And then we have a rather long dry spell, very long dry spell, in fact, between these 3 periods. And then, you know, for reasons which we can go into, new interest appears in religious communities. They aren't just safety valves. I'm not trying to suggest that they are safety valves, although for some people, religious communities have been that, you know, build a nest in the West and let the rest of the world go by sort of thing. There's no question for some people they have been that. I suppose there is some continuity in the fact that I think Roman Catholic monasteries as religious communities have gone on over a long, long period of time and have not been subject to, until recently, to, and now of course it's a whole different thing, but have not been subject to certain other kinds of economic and political and especially social forces operating in American history. But with the exception of the monasteries, and they are different because they're not voluntary. That is, they exist and they thrive because of strong central discipline. And there isn't, you know, independence or everybody doing his own thing at the monastery, and probably that's the reason they survive. But with that exception, I think we can find sort of 3 general periods in which there is intense interest, and then, you know, dying out, and then new interest again. And right now we're living in a period where there is intense interest in religious communities throughout and other kinds of small communities, throughout all parts of the United States. Okay. The first, as I suggested, the first period really comes from the time of the Puritans and lasts till almost the time of the separation from England in 1776. And the first religious communities in the United States were really products of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. Because as the Reformation took hold in certain parts of Germany, especially Switzerland, of course, with Calvin, and then into England, and then into Scandinavia, and so on. What generally happened, obviously, was that since we didn't have what we would call, you know, small d democratic government in those days, the religion or the denomination, I should say, of these provinces, if it's Brandenburg or, you know, Scotland or whatever it was, usually was the choice of the ruler of that particular province. And depending on the open-mindedness of the ruler himself, there was in some, but usually there wasn't very much religious toleration in any of the other for any of the other religions. Invariably, the rulers wanted everybody in their particular province to share the same religion they did, and hence we have obviously a great deal of religious persecution starting as early as the persecution against the Lutherans. In Germany, and then spreading out, you know, rather rapidly, because the idea existed at that time that you couldn't have religious harmony within a state if you had people squabbling and arguing over, you know, whether or not you'd be Catholic or Calvinist or Protestant or within Protestantism, Lutheran or Anglican or whatever. And therefore, the simplest way out to solve all the internal turmoil was simply to say everybody has to belong to one church, the beginning really of what we would call the state church or the established church. Now, as the Reformation spread, obviously, and especially as the idea of everybody being entitled to his or her own interpretation of the Bible, as that grew, obviously we had a multiplication of all kinds of small religious sects, especially in Germany. To some degree in England, but the English weren't really that hard on dissenters for a while. But in Germany we had a lot of these who took the principle of the open Bible and the idea of private interpretation, rather than depending on the Pope or depending on Luther or Calvin or whoever it was, and took this to, you know, its nth degree, to where, for instance, with the Quakers, everybody is totally, you know, equal. That there are no priests, there is no clergy, there is no hierarchy at all in churches such as the Quaker Church. And therefore, everybody is entitled to, you know, his or her own understanding. Now, obviously, out of this developed certain convictions, such as the Quakers had about not taking oaths, not being subject to the draft and all the rest, which ran into direct conflict with the established powers, because the Quakers said that they always told the truth, therefore it was unnecessary and it was immoral to be required to take an oath in court. And why should they do this? Because that was only a reminder, or only sort of a symbolic way of stating that they weren't telling the truth other times, and so they refused to take oaths. Or they refused military service because they became pacifists and took, you know, literally the commandment, thou shalt not kill, obviously, which got them in deep conflict with the existing orders. Further, as this kind of tension developed, certain sects, especially within Germany, developed the idea that they had, you know, a special clue or special insight or understanding as to what the true nature of the scriptures and the will of God really was all about. And we have what we still call, in broad terms, the whole emphasis on the saving remnant that lead to religious communities. That the established church was corrupt, the established church had sold out too much, you know, to the existing political, social, and economic orders of the day, and that God had singled out certain numbers of small groups, the term is especially saving remnant, so that they would be able to preserve the purity of the gospel and the purity of the will of God, you know, for the next generations. And as persecution now towards the Quakers, for instance, and some of the others developed, and as differences, for instance, over, you know, baptism, we just came from the one on baptism with Rich, and as differences over, you know, the ritual of baptism developed, obviously instead of people getting together and talking it over and trying to find some sort of harmony, people, you know, became that much more clannish and stuck together that much more, and persecution, of course, inevitably invites much more close or togetherness or close harmony among those people who are persecuted. And within Germany, we have especially all sorts of little pietistic groups. The Dunkers would be the best example of this, the Hutterites, the Amish, the Bruderhof, they came a little bit later, but you get the idea, who have special rituals and special understanding, as their way of putting understanding, as the scripture developed, who refuse to give this up and decide that they can no longer live in harmony with the existing orders, with the Prince of Brandenburg, if, I don't know if it was in Brandenburg or not, or wherever it was. And therefore, since they feel that the most important thing in their life is protecting their religious convictions, and to be able to hold on to these, because eventually there will come a day when God will allow their religious convictions to be spread, you see, through sort of an evangelical emphasis, that the most important thing for them to do is to separate, you see, from the existing, you know, order, from the status quo, and to move out physically and separate themselves. So we have, really starting with the Puritans, in England, coming in 1629, who were being persecuted by the Anglicans, forced to take communion, although they didn't believe in Anglican communion, forced to send their children to Anglican schools, although they didn't believe, you know, in the 39 Articles and so on. They came to the United States, and the United States really, in very real sense, with a few exceptions, was formed, the United States, each of the colonies, I should say, were formed as religious communities. Massachusetts certainly was one, and then Connecticut comes after this. Rhode Island was formed as a protest against the religious community in Massachusetts, but it was to be a place where there would be total religious, you know, freedom. Pennsylvania obviously was formed as the great haven for Quakers because there was real persecution of the Quakers in England, and it was William Penn who was able to bring these across. This is jumping way ahead of the story, but I was amused during the height of the Vietnam protest, when so many people were opposed to those who evaded the draft in this country. But I think if many of them, especially if they were of German or Scandinavian background, would look back to their great-grandfathers, I think you would find oftentimes their great-grandfathers came to this country in order to avoid the draft, especially Bismarck's army, or serving in the Swedish or the Norwegian army. Invariably, this was the case. And we honor and praise and sing hymns to our ancestors, at least back at St. Olaf we do almost. Oh, I just got done with centennial year, and so it'll take another 100 years to recover. But anyway, it's just a matter of, what time in history certain things are, worthwhile, and sometimes in which they're criticized. But anyway, what I'm suggesting is that there was this general pattern among all the early religious communities in the United States, which gave them a kind of cohesion and sense of purpose and mission, that they were a unique body. They were people singled out. They were chosen by God to do this sort of thing. And once you have that sort of mandate, or once you have that sort of sense of purpose and unification, that is an enormously strengthening kind of thing. It gives your whole movement a sense of cohesion and purpose, which otherwise you wouldn't have. If you were only out, you know, farming for yourself or into fishing or lumbering or whatever it is for yourself, you might not have that sense of purpose and dedication. But these people, you see, dared not fail. That's the point. Because if they failed, you know, in earning a living, in taming, as they like to call it, the howling wilderness, then really they were saying that God wasn't with them. And that was the last thing in the world, you know, they could admit, that God wasn't with them, because that would, you know, wipe out their whole basis of authority for the kind of life that they believed God had called them, you know, to enact. So we have the beginnings then of these religious communities, which form really kind of models for other kinds of religious communities which come along a little bit later. Now, in what sense did they fail? They failed in the sense that the original purpose of, for instance, the Puritans in Massachusetts failed, because its original idea was to purify the Church of England, and then go, they were to come over to this country, you know, come ye out and be separate and touch not the unclean thing, and then purify themselves. That's why they were called Puritans, and then go back and purify the state church or the Anglican church in England. That was the idea, and obviously they never went back, because the Anglican church became very strong under Charles II in the Restoration period. And if not the church became strong, at least his army became strong, and that has its own kind of, you know, language too, when you're deciding, you know, what kind of religion should be enacted in any given state. So they weren't able to do this, and the small German pietistic groups, the Bruderhof, the Amish, the Hutterites, and the others didn't go back to Germany also. Germany itself settled into a kind of two-religion or two-denomination pattern, basically Lutheran on the one hand and Catholic on the other, and there really wasn't much toleration or enthusiasm for these strange people who wore long, you know, unusual clothes and bonnets and said thee and thou, and also who developed one other practice which was not at all popular back at home, and that was a practice that I want to talk about, because in a minute, coming into the second wave, and that was a practice of having total public ownership of all property. Many of these pietistic groups started off with a kind of a communalism in which there was no such thing as private property. And obviously this was a very real threat, if you like, to the rulers, to the existing economic powers in any given state. And they wanted to isolate these people out if necessary, and if possible, get rid of them altogether. Because once you start talking about sharing all your property in common, even though it's in Acts 2, that becomes very threatening to your own sense of well-being and your own sense of you know, economic, or your own plans, I should say, for your own economic future. But I think the original intention of these communities wasn't carried out, because Europe changed itself and it would be impossible to go back to Europe for this. But the idea of religious communities in this vast expanse of America, which had so much, you know, open land, was still very much alive. There was no place, you see, in Germany or in Scandinavia or anything else for these people to go. If they wanted to be separate and have their own kind of community, they couldn't move around. There was no safety valve or escape hatch for them, because everywhere they went, you know, the country had been settled. It had been settled, obviously, for centuries. But in the United States, there was this enormous amount of free land available for them, and most of them had the idea anyway that the best way in which they could restore purity and maintain a sense of real community would be through economic interdependence one on another, rather than having direct connections with the existing economic status quo. So we have starting, we have the original movements fading out, although, you know, states like Pennsylvania and Rhode Island kept pretty much their own character as terms of openness to new kinds of religious bodies were concerned. But the second wave of interest in religious communities comes in the 1830s and the 1840s. And very briefly on this, these were different in that the most important thing about the many different religious groups, we call them the come-outer groups, so there are dozens of them. The best known one, of course, is the Mormon one. But there were John Humphrey Noyes, and there was also many examples you could give, the fellow in New Harmony, Indiana, Robert Owen, and dozens of small little groups that conquered Brook Farm with all the Transcendentalists and so on. Their basic idea was that if they could separate from, you know, the corrupt existing status quo and go out into the wilderness, separate for a period of time, they could learn to live with one another, get rid of, you know, the greed and the competitiveness that's inherent in private property. And once you've done that, you've not only changed the economic structure, but you've, in a very real sense, you know, wiped out all man's acquisitive nature, and they were convinced that it was man's acquisitive nature to have more goods, more wealth, more property, that was at the root of their problems, why they couldn't have a genuine and authentic religious community. So we have all sorts of these little groups from New England all the way out to Salt Lake, starting in the 1830s and the 1840s. Now, the thing that made them different from the other groups was that they invariably believed in a kind of religious perfectionism. Very, very strongly, if any of you know the leading revivalist preacher of the time, Charles Grandison Finney, he was preaching a kind of a sanctification or a kind of a holiness which was unique really to America, and which I think is really indigenous to America in the 19th century, because there was such high hope with all this new land and the chance to start over again, that once you found the right formula, once you got the right arrangement of community, that you could achieve a kind of a perfection here on earth. Obviously, they weren't very good Calvinists or Lutherans when they were perfectionists, but you know, there weren't very many of the old European forces at work anyway. But the idea here is separate from the community, go out and become a self-sufficient economic community itself, so that you weren't dependent on to a large degree on the outside world. Learn to share, learn to give, learn to grow together, as we would say, in 1960s kind of language. And from that kind of experience, whole new beings, virtually morally perfected beings, would appear, and they would have then the resources and the mission and the enthusiasm to go out, and to save the world. This was the idea of really regenerating the entire world. They didn't, they didn't stop with just regenerating themselves. This is what's going to happen, as we'll see in the 1960s movement, where everybody, drops out. They can only save themselves, but in the 1830s and the 40s, like with the Mormons, and even today, the Mormons are a perfect example. They send missionaries out. I'm sure if I ask for a show of hands, most of you have talked with these very earnest, earnest they are, young missionaries, 18, 19, 20 years old, who come along, and you always can spot them, especially, for instance, in Northfield, because at that age, you just don't see many 18-year-olds wearing black suits and, in white shirts anymore. But they, and short hair, that's another one. But they came, they come, and it's a part of their obligation to do so. Some of us know from St. Olaf Jean England would be a good example of he spent 2 years in missionary work. They get something like $75 a month, isn't it? They eat a lot of donuts, I remember. They don't have much money to eat a lot of anything else that's filling, but they eat, I remember, and they are always carrying along a little white, bakery bag, because that's about all the money. And I asked them, they said that's about all the money, that fills them up the fastest with the lowest cost. But the idea there was, once you establish the right kind, of relationships, who works where, and who has what jobs, who's in authority, who does what, then people will see the advantages, of living in this kind of community, and they will want that kind of community, and they will gladly surrender all the old hang-ups about private property and about competition and about getting ahead and about status and power and all these things, and they will voluntarily choose this new kind of life. That's the point. No coercion. No Pope, no Martin Luther, no John Calvin or Knox or anybody else telling them, that they have to behave in a certain way. But voluntarily, they will see that perfectionism, is the best possible way. And once a person has decided to choose, some way of life for himself or herself voluntarily, obviously it's much more real and personal and, worth advancing, rather than being coerced into anything. And they were convinced this was the case. And you find, for instance, with the Mormon Church, it was voluntary. They didn't go around and kidnap people or bring them in or use any other kind of coercion or force, but they simply appealed, I should say, to the sense of living in this kind of community, so that through the experience, they would become regenerated and they would literally shut off their former selves and become new beings altogether. And this caught on with a large number of people in the 30s and 40s. Perhaps today, we are too cynical. I've thought about this because sometimes I've wondered, what kind of a life it would be like that. But these people weren't so cynical or pessimistic about the future as probably we, maybe for good reason, are today. But they really believed in something like an unlimited future. That if you take the promises, for instance, of the New Testament seriously, And if you take seriously the idea that in the first community in Jerusalem did sell all its property and share all things in common and work from that basis on, then what's to say that this hasn't happened, you know, this can't happen again? And the Mormons, just for example, I don't want to keep using them, but they are the best known one, I'm sure, for all of us, really believe that there's sort of this gap in history. Some of you may have heard or seen, you know, the lecture. In fact, when we had them in, they did this chart of the teachers, elders, prophets, deacons, you know, and all the rest, the New Testament church. And then they sort of fold the paper and they have some lines, and then they talk about the structure of the Mormon church. And then it's just like the back of Mad magazine, if you've ever folded it, you know, together and get a new picture. They fold it together, and what they are saying is that the kind of church that they, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young founded, was the new kind of church which is now appeared, you see, once again in the 19th century, and that they've gone back to New Testament principles. And they've gotten rid of all this business of Catholicism and Orthodoxy and Lutheranism and everything in between, and that they've got the original pure church. Well, once more, and when you've got the original pure church, and if you have the same kind of powers and resources that the first Christians did at Pentecost, then there's no limit, obviously, to where you can go and, you know, what you can accomplish. And they really believe that, you know, they had this. All right. Most of, with the exception of the Mormon church, all the other small religious communities failed. Throughout the country. The most amusing one was the one at Brook Farm. All these heavy intellectuals, Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thoreau and Hawthorne and goodness knows who else, lived in Brook Farm for a while, and, you know, this was going to be ideal, just sort of go out into the country and just sort of, you know, be and exist and, you know, not worry about all the other practical problems. But one reason, Bronson Alcott, the father of Louisa May Alcott of Little Women, and Alcott wrote a marvelous little explanation of why Brook Farm failed, and he gave one example. It was one spring, and they were trying to bring in supplies on a cart, and it was a very muddy road, and the axle broke right in the deepest part of a mud, a big mud pile, and nobody knew how to get that axle either fixed or out, so they all had to wait for their supplies to come in until the road dried. And they all sat around talking about transcendentalism and the oversoul and the good, the true, and the beautiful, but nobody knew how to get that, you know, cart out of the mud pile. And as a result, you know, as we would say politely, you know, tensions emerged within the community. To put it mildly, I didn't know anything about jacks or anything like that. And as a result, you know, the old cliche was true here, all chiefs and no braves. And this oftentimes happens even today in many of the communities, because communities are founded and operated by people who have very strong convictions. It takes real convictions and a sense of purpose to leave, you know, air conditioning and color TV and all the other things, and to be able to exist out in a rural, you know, very simple, simplistic kind of environment. And as a result, many people have a great deal of time, difficulty, I should say, compromising, but that's getting a little ahead of the story. One reason these communities in the 30s and 40s broke down, though, was simply a lack of practical information on how to survive, so to speak, and not in the wilderness, but at least out, you know, in these areas. They used the ideal of farming and of small crafts as their goal to become economically self-sufficient, but most of them knew very little about it. And I was just fascinated. I just saw the last, on how this thing is sort of being restored, in the last issue or two issues ago of Newsweek, out in Idaho, they've just founded a new farm in which you are simply taught all the skills necessary for, you know, living on the land. Fencing, farming, planting, weaving, you know, dairying, whatever. There's a farm up in somewhere in Idaho, I forget the name of the town, place, where you're simply taught all these things and you provide your own food. It's free, but you provide your own food, and they had 50 students the first couple of weeks. And, you know, it's an interesting sort of idea of getting back to the land again and purification for this, and recognizing that you can't have a community, a successful community, unless you know something about fencing and know something about planting and know something about all the other practical chores that go along with this. You just simply can't go out and depend, you know, on things sort of to fall in place. And this certainly was one of the lessons. Another, obviously, another reason that the communities in the 30s and the 40s failed was enormous hostility from the existing centers of population. The Mormons were, as you know, physically persecuted. In fact, you can't have anything worse than having your leader, you know, murdered, and that's what happened to Joseph Smith in Nauvoo, Illinois. And obviously the Mormons got the message, you know, that they weren't, you know, welcome. There was no welcome wagon out for them when they rolled into a new community. And because of this kind of hostility, obviously, they were forced out of good lands. Oftentimes when they did have to buy things like seed or anything else to get, or equipment, harness, whatever, to get started, they were cheated. usually by the pillars of the local congregations back in Zion, Illinois, or whatever. No, Zion's another religious community that got started. But some of the other ones, because they didn't want people like this around. And of course, with Mormons, with polygamy, you know, the answer, I mean, the cliche, I think, was invented there, you know, would you want your daughter to marry one? Think about that for a minute. Because they were four or five, sometimes more, brides to a husband. We were with this, and obviously this caused a great deal of consternation. And in a couple of communities, there was resistance because of some of the social practices, the most famous of these, but it's far too exaggerated, and that would be the Oneida community under John Humphrey Noyes, in Oneida, New York, where they practiced what they called mixed marriages, in which you could marry and cohabit with any other member of the opposite sex in your community under, you know, strict regulations. And a lot of people began to worry about, you know, what might happen to the rest of to the family and all the rest if this existed. And the whole, as I say, the Mormon practice of polygamy also was seen as, you know, as something very undesirable. Although the Mormons claimed under the First Amendment, you know, that they were simply practicing religious freedom, and religious freedom is guaranteed. And this is still, you know, a legitimate, I think, a legitimate kind of question. Some of you remember 7, 8 years ago, the question about forcing Amish children into public schools. And I still remember that terrible, that awful picture. It was in the old Life magazine of some rangers with their Smokey the Bear hat on horseback chasing some little Amish children into the cornfield. You know, like these were real enemies of the state and real threats, you know, to the, you know, security of America, and these little long-coated, long-haired Amish children running off into the cornfield to avoid, you know, the local constable trying to drag them into the school. And I still remember that terrible, that awful picture. It was in the old Life magazine of some rangers with their Smokey the Bear hats on horseback chasing some little Amish children into the cornfield. You know, like these were real enemies of the state and real threats, you know, to the, you know, security of America, and these little long-coated, long-haired Amish children running off into the cornfield to avoid, you know, the local constable trying to drag them into the school. But now it was Hughes in Iowa who worked out the first, if I'm not mistaken, the first satisfactory settlement on this, where they have pretty much the same basic curriculum in their own schools, but they still have control over the schools themselves, so that they don't have to be subject to the state on this. But the state compromised more than the religious communities did, and it's a legitimate kind of concern. But that's getting a little off the story. So I think for these reasons, the economic reason and the resistance that these communities met from the state, and also from, you know, internal troubles, the communities of the 1840s and the 50s died out. And if any had existed into 1860s, certainly they dropped out of sight altogether with the coming of the Civil War. The Civil War was such a traumatic experience that it simply caught up everybody in it one way or another, and was the United States obviously wasn't the same country afterwards by any stretch of the imagination. So we have then a long, long jump from the 1840s to the next and the final period, the period we're in now, of concern and involvement in religious concern communities in America. And this would be the one starting in the early 1960s and going right up to the present in this country. And these are, again, somewhat similar, but again, somewhat different from other religious communities that have existed before. And it's very difficult to make any sort of general comments on these, because you find all sorts of different communities appearing. not only religious communities, such as Holden, for instance, appearing and so on, but you have those who are dedicated to very specific and, by, you know, earlier standards, narrow ends. You have down in Maryland, I forget the name of the town, an experiment aimed at carrying out the principles of B.F. Skinner in Walden, too. I think it's Twin Oaks. Excuse me. The town is called Twin Oaks, or the commune itself is called Twin Oaks, in which you take Skinner's principles of reinforcement and you simply try to create, you know, a kind of utopia right there. And for some people, apparently it's doing quite well. There's some stability and there's not too much population turnover, but then on the other hand, it doesn't have more than 50 people in it. So if there's sort of an original screening out process that takes place in the first place, you wouldn't go to a Skinner community if you didn't really believe in the principles of B.F. Skinner, and therefore you're much more willing to to adapt and to cooperate by going there in the first place. And there have been all sorts of other kinds of communities that have emerged. A lot of them are small, fundamentalistic, and usually charismatic religious communities who have aimed at rehabilitation of the individual, especially people who before were heavily into the drug scene on the West Coast. I found when I was writing the book on the Jesus people, especially on the West Coast, not just Oregon, especially the Shiloh houses, if any of you know the Shiloh houses are the best example of this, and in California, all over, a few individuals would go out, get a farm, get a small crafts industry, whatever it might be, and open up the doors for a kind of full ministry to any individuals who might want to come. And inevitably, the appeal was out to those who wanted to get out from the kind of, the drug scene, the alcohol scene, whatever it might be before, and sort of come out into the rural area. And there, through a purge of their old habits and committing themselves to a restoration, you know, of rebirth and new growth again through, you know, direct contact with, you know, Mother Earth, to be able to be new creatures. And what worked in these communities, the thing that held them together, since they had people coming from all over the country of all different age groups and education levels, was the commitment to a new kind of religious life, which was the central purpose, the idea being there that once you had made a commitment to renewal, you had new resources and new powers for living this kind of life which you didn't have before, and that you could share and grow, you know, with one another in these kind of communities. And they deliberately kept themselves small, they deliberately kept themselves virtually anonymous. They didn't, I can give you a good example of that. They didn't like people coming around investigating. And one I found from some of the interviews I did with some of them that one of the chief amusements every day was to go down and get the mail and get the latest questionnaire from some professor of sociology or history. Will you please fill this out and return it to us so we can investigate, you know, your community and understand it more clearly? They would all have a good laugh over this and simply, you know, then crumple it up and, you know, throw it away. So much for, scientific investigation, because many of them had been or were college graduates and didn't like to be, you know, considered specie, you know, to be put into a little jar of formaldehyde and pickled and put on the jar and investigated as many of the sociologists and many historians, were wont to do. And this kind of these kind of communities appeared along with some those such as Walden too in the 1960s. And others were aimed primarily at personal growth through living together in urban communities. Not all of these were rural. In urban communities, where all the daily tasks of living in a large house were shared, and where people learned to where people learned the necessity of cooperation, of taking care of the daily ordinary routine tasks, dishwashing and dusting and all the rest, in order to appreciate the larger goal which would be served, namely that of actually living together and sharing all these things, in common, rather than simply living, but two by two. They would live in anywhere from 7 to 8, maybe 15 different people in any given community. And there they would pool all their resources. This was the important point, that if you were to live in these kind of communities, either rural, but in this case urban communities, you would simply turn over your income to the community, and the community itself would decide through, what we would call participatory democracy, which became the big thing in the 60s, how this income was to be used, what kind of In what kind of ways would it be invested? What repairs would be made? You know, how it would be administered? And one submitted himself or herself to the discipline of the community, with the idea being of personal growth through this kind of discipline, but the greater good that would be served, you see, through sharing this kind of involvement. And for many people, this kind of commitment and this kind of sharing and this kind of enforced discipline was the answer to what we, you know, called and still call, you know, the rat race. Invariably, these kinds of communes appealed mostly to upper middle class, college educated people who simply got tired of commuting, of all the office politics, you know, all the rest of the thing, the busyness, the committee meetings that we talked about earlier and all this that go with this, and found that by contrast to the groups in the 30s, this was the point, that they could no longer save the world. They could no longer, you know, go back and purify the Church of England, or as the Mormons had thought they could do in the 40s, go out and save Christendom, you know, for themselves. But the one thing they could do by this kind of close community discipline kind of living would be at least to save themselves from the rat race, to restore a sense of integrity and self-respect to one another, and to get, you know, directly personally involved to in this. Rather than sitting at a desk pushing around papers and counting paper clips and all the rest, you could go out into the country and actually feel, you know, the earth. I give you a very good example in near Northfield, where we have a music director from a very successful Twin City High School, one of the best Twin City High Schools in, you know, all of the Twin Cities, and doing very well, you know, had all the everything going for him, and yet it was, you know, just too much, and he dropped out, and now he's a chicken farmer near Zumbrota, which is a small community not too far from there, and he's much happier there because he can see, you know, everything that he does. He has some direct connection between his efforts and what he puts in and what, you know, what comes back. Or we have one near our home, a very successful engineer. I don't know what kind of salary he had, but he just became a manipulator. He just became somebody who organized and who drew diagrams and who gave orders to other people, and other people did his work for him. And it was all too much for him. He dropped out, and now he's into chicken or egg production himself. Paul Tullison, if any of you know from near there, and is excited. He works hard. He works 12, 14 hours a day, but he has a sense, you know, of involvement in to what is basic and fundamental in life, rather than getting so far out that he's lost touch with reality. But the most important point is that some people have seen the answer to what we would call alienation and frustration, all of these things, not in, you know, holding on to the old traditional American ideals of individualism, you know, free enterprise, competition, and all these things, but through living in small, sharing, you know, caring kind of communities. Not a great number of them. I think if we were to look at the total numbers, there would be an actual decline in 1975 from the number that there were existence maybe, you know, 5 years ago. But I don't think it'd be, you know, too significant a statistical decline itself, because those who are there, I think, are pretty well committed to this sort of thing. All right. So that's I think that's the basic difference with the religious communities and these other kind of communities in our day, is that they are not really intended as a force, as a center for total rehabilitation, with the idea being of going out again and preserving the world. But rather they are aimed at the individual restoring a sense of well-being and harmony and community with one another, and that you can't survive any longer according to the old competitive norms. The old survival of the fittest, you know, Darwinian kind of ideals, but the only way you can survive in our kind of world is through the kind of sharing, and if this means surrender of private property and acceptance of the discipline of the group, then that's, you know, what's going to be required, and they hope that this kind of ideal will, you know, catch on and will expand out. Now, generally speaking, these religious communities, and this is sort of the transition, and I want to end at this point for and then start the discussion, is that these communities invariably have existed outside or at the best on the very periphery of the organized or the institutional church. Many times people have dropped out and formed these kinds of communities because they see the church as getting involved in certain things in which they don't want to get involved. Either the church, you know, the church can't win on this. Either the church, you know, is too sort of otherworldly and does too much preaching and not enough reaching out, or else the church is too involved in the social gospel and you never hear any kind of strong religious emphasis in this. I give you one example of this. When I was doing interviewing, a man told me why he didn't go to church anymore. He said, "I used to go to church and hear the name of Jesus Christ preached, and now I go to church and I'm told I can't eat grapes." He didn't like that. On the other hand, people go to church and feel if the church doesn't make any difference, you know, in this life, with injustice and all the rest, then it really has just become, you know, sort of another worldly kind of club. And for that reason, I think these kinds of religious communities probably don't touch on the lives of most of us, because most of us choose to live within the, you know, the structures of, you know, what we'll call more traditional kind of society on this. But I think they are a reminder that there are a significant number of people who don't share this kind of vision that we do, but who feel that they are called to a different kind of discipleship, to a different kind of service in this way, and that they present not just an alternative to us, but I think they present a kind of a judgment on, you know, some of the things we consider to be, you know, the most important and fundamental in our kind of lives. And I would like to suggest or ask you here, might you want to live in one of these kinds of communities, a small kind of separated community? Or if not, why not?
Well, when our children were younger, I thought it was about the advantages to the wives that they could, instead of each woman trying to watch small kids cook, clean, and go to the grocery store at the same time, they could kind of four or five get together and kind of divide it up. So one would watch all the kids and the other one would do the cleaning and stuff like that. But I never really had any desire to, completely cool resources.
There's no question where it works well, this kind of system is much more efficient, and frankly it's much more ecological in the best sense, because you don't have everybody, you know, doing everything all the time, but you're able to share in, you know, the dishwashing and cut back on the electricity, cut back on the use of natural resources, detergents and so on. And you take turns, raising and watching the children. This got to be a big hassle. Remember all the daycare centers the government was going to finance, and people saw these as terrible threats, you know, to the sanctity of the family.
We discovered here, though, even in the winter community, that you have to have the old ping an of the Chinese is true. You have to have one woman under one roof. You've got to separate that.
Yeah, I don't mean, you know, breaking up any kind of, traditional discipline of the family. But I'm suggesting that you don't have to have, you know, one woman can watch four children one day and the other woman can watch four children the next day.
Don't you find even in the co-ops in these all neighborhoods, we've got right on the telephone post by our house in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
There was a new co-op for our block. I mean, co-op buying is in, isn't it?
Right. We do it ourselves.
Yeah. Everybody's in on that almost.
Yes. And I just wish it would make a more of a dent, you know, in the big structure. But I think that's coming, and I think that's...
Isn't it already affecting the big food market?
I would hope so. I just, you know, we... I don't know if I have enough information, but I think that's one very positive and constructive result. There's no reason you have to have piped-in music and carpeting, and I don't know, we go to one where it's just cement floor and all the boxes are put out and you do your own marking with a little grease pencil on the top, and the PA system consists of somebody yelling to the other end of the warehouse, and they don't have free coffee and movies for the kids and so on. But anyway. That's one example of cooperation in that kind of community. Yeah.
But don't you have to be involved in that co-op?
Cost $2 a year.
That's all. Yeah. Work? Because our co-op, it's a lot of you, your effort. I mean, you run the store.
Yeah, but it is much time.
It's more than a lot of people are willing to give, and this is, to me, it's going to create a widening gap between the class merchants. Those that have got the money to buy the goods in your big supermarkets are
going to,
there's no way they want to get into that hassle of the co-op.
Well, I don't think that's true. We go out the area, and everybody's in the co-op, but I think it creates an elitism. All the professors are in it from the University of Minnesota. The doctors' wives want to spend on something else besides food, because they're always broke. So they're glad to get in on that too. It's anything but rich and poor.
It's evolved more down here than it has up there.
It's
just started in the last 5 years, so it's still evolving.
Is it that they don't like to do the extra busy work?
Yeah.
Well, then they miss the whole sense of what a co-op is all about.
That's right. But it's because it's just evolving. And there are so few of them, just waiting for the 300 to get in. That's right, you know, we must do it.
I wonder.
Well, I have a question. I've read an article or two about some of those earlier communities, the 1800 ones, and it seemed like the common factor was they usually were started by a strong leader.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that.
And when he died,
Inevitably.
Is that true of today also? Is there any sort of these little houses that you investigated, is it usually being held together by one person?
I'd say more often not, because in some necessarily there had to be a strong leader to start it and to, you know, get things underway. But where I know there are exceptions to this. Lawrence Vesey's book on this would disagree with me. But in the most cases, I found that the necessity for living together and giving up everything convinced the participants of the necessity of involving themselves in the day by day decisions, as well as maintaining the whole sense of personality and character to the community itself. And it depends on what kind of authority the leader would claim. If he claimed divine inspiration just for himself, and then he dispensed this to the group, if people were willing to accept this, then fine, if he became something of a prophet. But on the other hand, if it was somebody who simply was an arranger or a convener to get things started, inevitably very serious class conflict, not class, but personality conflict would develop. And especially in those places we call intentional communities, where there was a high ideal or a goal to be achieved through forming this kind of community. And where that was the case and everybody shared in that goal and vision, they didn't want to surrender too much of it to any one individual or small faction.
Yeah, I don't mean by a strong leader necessarily a Hitler.
But
somebody that everybody likes so well that they, anything he suggests, everybody agrees.
Well, usually what happened, and we haven't had enough of these to have a long-range view, is that the leader lived so closely and intimately with the others that it was impossible for him to maintain the sort of distance and mystique about the leadership necessary, because they saw him, you know, warts and all, as a human being, as well as being, you know, like Brigham Young. Young was able to isolate himself out, and he was able to succeed because he had such extraordinary ability, both as a religious prophet and then as somebody who could handle day-by-day affairs. But there just aren't that many, you know, that kind of leaders in these kinds of communities. I'm sorry, yeah.
In communes, I see disharmony developing because one person feels that the other person isn't doing his share, or he wants to listen to music while I have to go out and hold the beans and things like that. Did this Walden, was it Walden?
Walden too.
Did that situation, was that resolved there?
Yeah, where I should have mentioned too, and I'm sorry about the leadership thing, about discipline is crucial. The communities that have succeeded are the ones that have had the strongest discipline, and sometimes a coerced discipline. The intentional communities very rarely have succeeded. There was a whole flock of them in New Mexico, Taos County, New Mexico, where everybody just sort of came down and tented, and somehow a community was supposed to, you know, appear out of this, and it never did. But where there was strong discipline, then the people accepted this and were able to, you know, go on from there. In Walden too, they have it built in, where if you don't do your share, you know, you get the less, you know, popular kinds of jobs to do. And you build up a system. It's like wages, really. I mean, you surrender private property, but you still have a sense of wages, because you if you take the less popular jobs, you have to put in fewer hours a day, you know, like cleaning the calf pens. Some of you would know that that's not exactly the most desirable, you know, job. So you would have to do that maybe 4 hours a day, but if you were in the kitchen, you'd have to put in 8 hours a day. And if you didn't do your share, there would be sort of general group disapproval, but then they would see to it through the discipline of the group that you would be given your reward by getting extra duty with this. In a way, it's like the military. I remember I got KP 4 days in a row because I sassed the first sergeant, and I still think of peeling potatoes at 4 a.m, you know, as a form of discipline. And that's what the army is a kind of a community too, and that's what happened in places like Walden.
It's my impression that the Hutterites are still going strong. Do you have any reason why they've been able to?
Well, one, they've been able to keep up the sense of the saving remnant, you know, generation after generation. They've been able to seal themselves off from existing society. They don't allow other people in unless these others are totally committed right from the very beginning to their community. They've been able to seal off the outside community. That's very important for this kind of community, to have total discipline over everybody all the time and a clear sense of identification with it. And many times the beards and the language and the menu and all the rest are further sort of reinforcements of this sense of unique, identity that they've had.
Who imposes this discipline?
They have the elders, are the chief group, and the elders have, it's much like the old elders in the Puritan churches back in, Puritan New England.
They elected?
They emerge and they elect themselves. It's like a board of directors that they have this process whereby those who are superior in sense of leadership skills simply will emerge and the community will recognize them. Excuse me?
By common consensus.
Common consensus, and then not everybody shares equally in the power. And the elders have the final authority for discipline. We're with them, and I think that's the key. If you want that sort of thing, and of course a lot of people do, and that's what makes it so interesting, because it's in such contradiction to traditional American individualism.
So there is a marked difference there between them and some of these newer.
Oh yeah, the Hutterites are an entirely different kind of thing than,
because it's a highly economic thing. They're extremely successful financially. We have them in South Dakota.
Right.
They can just go out and buy big globs of land because they just. But the thing they're running into a problem is with inbreeding, almost you'd call it, and they're starting to take girls or boys, whatever, up into Canada to other groups and bring them back down from there, because they're really starting to have some trouble with their bloodlines.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? For goodness sake. I didn't. That's interesting. But they work. The Hutterites and the Bruderhof and the rest work economically, and since they work economically, this is proof to them that God is with them. And they are very successful. Anytime there's, trouble, like a tornado or something that comes through, wasn't this in Indiana a few years ago? There was a tornado that wiped out some barns and different things, and the Hutterites, from simply all over the country, came there and simply built up everything again and then went back home again. And as I remember too, wasn't it after one of the marches in Washington, wasn't it one of these religious groups that came in simply and cleared up everything without being asked or prompted to? It's voluntary in the sense that the surrender of self to the higher good of the community.
Well, it does seem to be a community or concept that does seem to work for a fairly large group of people.
Yes, they need the reinforcement that they are a chosen remnant, though. That's crucial, that they see themselves as set apart. They don't say that their style or their lifestyle is true for all people. But those that succeed, the same with the Catholic monasteries, they succeed also because they are set apart. And you need that as reinforcement. Of course, sometimes people get, like in book crime, they get weary of that. And that's where all the skills of the community come into play to keep the sense alive. And it's much worse now with television and radio and all the rest, because there are so many more attractions for the young people. I know it's a different kind of community, but the Native American community has this. I was driving once back through Black River Falls, Wisconsin, and stopped for a root beer, and here were seven or eight 13, 14 year old Indians listening to rock music on a transistor and really digging it, and I was kind of sad. That was kind of a sad thing to see, because no, they don't. No, that is a fascinating thing there on the First Amendment too, whether or not they did use the public roads, and they don't use any motorized vehicles, and they use horse and buggy. And you remember a few years ago they required any vehicle on public roads to have the orange triangle, for slow moving vehicles on tractors. For some of you from the asphalt jungles, you don't know what I'm talking about, but any slow moving vehicle has to have on the back a aluminized orange triangle that you fasten on. And the Hutterites refused to do that because it was a graven image. And this went to court. It's a fascinating thing. This went to court, and the courts ruled against the Hutterites because they were using the public road, and according to the general welfare clause in the Constitution, the government has the right to regulate the common welfare on the public roads, and it is a good safety device to have slow-moving vehicles single out as such. And that overruled their religious conviction that they shouldn't be subjected to using graven images in which they didn't believe. George?
Well, I was going to say, as far as communal movement in urban areas, you know, you're talking about the withdrawal. I see a real need to translate that into a society, because most of us live in urban areas. So as far as an outreach, maybe that's a different thing than going on in the communal, but is there much development of communal living as service, not to change mankind, but just to help people in a particular area? I'd be excited about something like that.
It's very, we got to talk about that last time, you remember, and we got to talk about the church in Washington and the one in Houston and all that. It's very isolated. But where it has worked, it's worked very well. The Church of the Redeemer, the Episcopalian Church in Houston, is the best example of this altogether. And there's one in Washington which requires very strict discipleship. But it depends again on leaders, and it depends on having the right number of people at the right time in the right area doing things like this. And it doesn't seem to be spreading especially quickly, as far as I can tell. But in certain areas, it provides a kind of alternative of discipleship. In urban areas, because the urban areas are obviously here to stay, they're very promising, especially among some of the younger people in the 20s and the 30s, who are tired of the rat race and don't want to get into it. Like that wonderful cartoon, two people, young people, were talking, and one said, "I decided to be a failure early in life and save myself a lot of grief."
Is Holden the largest one that's based on this kind of a temporary community where people come in for a short period and then move on?
Carol, would you care to?
It seems like every culture has only got one of our type, this type of thing.
We have this wide range of interests.
Yeah, I don't know of any within other mainstream Protestant bodies that have anything like Holden.
Kirkridge is the most similar, and that only holds about 100. And they've had a lot of large corporation companies. They do a lot of alcoholism, too. Mm. They've had a very staunch history. I like it very much in the New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. John Oliver Nelson has had that from the Yale faculty.
Oh, sure.
That's only another one in the United States. And right north of it, one starting for the ancients in Canada. It's rather interesting. They have a much smaller setup, but it's very viable. I mean, it'll go not be something that people fade away. Our problem in America on these is there's so many people get fed up with being a pastor, and then he thinks about starting a retreat. Somebody gives him a farm or some island or something, then he gets going, and it lasts for a couple of years and falls flat on his face, and it hurts all of them because of that. They have never been able to keep remaining this way. Mm. But in Europe, you have Iona and the British Isles, and Agape in Italy, Paisa in France.
Right.
So it seems like there's one each culture.
So you're in a very important historical setting right now. Really?
Well, we have this expansive sort of thing, like Paisa, they almost do like ours, except you can almost tailor-make your own. You come up and say what do you want, and then because they have a permanent brothers and sisters community, I mean, that's a Presbyterian-dominated theology.